corner than he had in her. April hesitated just inside the doorway. The thought of worming through the crowd to the bar discouraged her, and she'd never get to talk to the barmaids anyway. They were too busy.
"Hey, April! What are you drinking?"
It was one of the technicians. April recognized his face but couldn't quite place his name. "White wine," she said, falling back into the slightly defensive mode of speech that she had inherited from her native Virginia. The guy dove into the crowd and reappeared a minute later with a glass of wine in one hand and a tumbler of something stronger in the other.
"Haven't seen you around here for a while," he said,
guiding her toward an unoccupied booth with a big grin on his face. She accepted the wine and his hand on the small of her back.
"It's been terribly busy."
"Yeah, the crash and then Tenney getting killed. Most of the people in my group are wondering how long we've got before Randolph lays us off."
"He's fighting awfully hard to avoid that," April said, sliding into the booth, resigning herself to the fact that her attempt at detective work was going to result in nothing more than listening to this man's troubles and finding an excuse to get away without hurting his feelings. Across the crowded, noisy room, though, another Astro employee watched April chatting with the technician. He was a data manager in Astro's personnel department, and he knew that Dan Randolph's executive assistant had been reviewing personnel records for the past several days. She had scanned Pete Larson's file several times. He had a buddy in Houston who paid good money to be informed about what Randolph was up to. He decided to call his buddy, who worked at Tricontinental Oil, and let him know what April Simmons was doing. The rumor was that Tricontinental was going to buy Astro out. A lot of money is going to change hands, he thought. I might as well get some of it for myself. By the time Claude Passeau entered the bar, the after-work crowd had dissipated. April was long gone, driving alone to catch the last ferry of the evening. The technician who'd bought her a drink drove his own car into the ferry and even followed April partway to her apartment in Lamar, but lost his nerve halfway there and turned back to his own place, a house he shared with three other Astro employees. A soft instrumental was purring from the music system, a blessed relief from the usual doleful nasalities that the bar's clientele seemed to enjoy. Passeau grimaced at the thought of trying to pick a decent wine from the selection stocked at the bar. Instead, he ordered a brandy, longing for a sip of Armagnac, but settling for the Presidente that Dan had recommended. Sitting alone in the same booth that April had occupied, he wrestled with his conscience. Dan wants to launch his space plane, to prove that the crash was sabotage.
I can't be a party to that.
It would ruin my career. So Dan cleverly offers me a free vacation on the Riviera. The nerve of the man. Despite himself, Passeau smiled at the thought of it. Out-and-out bribery. We'd both go to jail. And yet, Passeau admired Dan's drive, his daring, his willingness to risk everything. And, at heart, Passeau agreed that the first space plane's crash was no accident. Someone very cleverly sabotaged the plane. Someone with deep technical capabilities and enormous resources. Someone extremely dangerous. If only there were a shred of evidence to show. A young woman entered the bar. The few men still perched on stools swiveled their heads to check her out. Pert, thought Passeau. That's the kind of woman that defined the word. She was slim, cute, a sprinkling of freckles across her snub nose, strawberry blonde hair cut short. She wore a t-shirt with some sort of slogan across the chest and a pair of ragged cutoffs. Good legs. Not much bosom. She spotted Passeau and walked straight to his booth. Surprised and more than a little flattered, Passeau got to his feet as she approached.
"Mr. Passeau, I'm Kelly Emmons."
Passeau's welcoming smile faltered. "From the FBI office?" he asked, knowing it was a foolish question. She sat across the table from him and lowered her voice slightly.
"Special Agent Kelly Emmons," she elaborated with a nod. "I work with Special Agent Chavez."
Trying to recover his aplomb, Passeau said, "You seem much too young to be an FBI agent." She smiled, showing perfectly straight white teeth.
"Looks can be deceiving, Mr. Passeau."
He recommended a Presidente for her,
Instead, she ordered a cherry Coke. Texas girl, Paso realized. Once the cola arrived, Emmons ignored it.
I need to get your straight-up opinion on what Dan Randolph told us.
About the crash?
And about the death of his chief engineer, Joseph Tenney.
Paso nodded.
Well, what's your take on it?
He shook his head. How much of my career has depended on going along with the system, keeping quiet, staying out of the limelight? 20 years of patient servitude, and what has it got me? A wife who has left me, 2 children who won't even speak to me, a mortgage on a house I'm not allowed to enter. In 5 years I could take early retirement. 5 years more. Emmons leaned toward him, totally unaware of Paso's inner turmoil.
I really need to know, she said earnestly. Even if you only...
I believe the space plane was sabotaged, Paso heard himself say, slightly surprised at his own words. I have no evidence that clearly shows it, but that is my belief.
Emmons sank back on the booth's bench. She was no longer smiling.
I see, she said.
Then that means there's a chance that Tenney was murdered.
And that means that Astro Corporation had a spy, a saboteur in its midst.
Had?
The man Larson? The one who committed suicide?
Emmons nodded, understanding.
Maybe that's where I should start, with him. They talked until the barmaid came over and unceremoniously announced,
Last call. We close in 15 minutes.
Emmons got up and left, her original cherry Coke still untouched on the booth's varnished table. Paso gulped down the brandy that had been sitting before him since the FBI agent had arrived. Then he rose too and headed for the door. As he stepped out into the dank, humid, hot night, alive with the buzz of insects and distant groaning calls of lovesick frogs, Paso finally made up his mind.
I will not go to the Riviera. That would be too obvious. I'll take a vacation week and return to New Orleans. Perhaps my children will consent to let me see them. By the time I return to Matagorda, Dan's test flight will be a fait accompli.
Back in the Astro Motel bar, the barmaid took the untouched Coke and delicate brandy glass back to the sink, thinking,
a couple of big boozers they were, and he's a lousy tipper, too.
Planning. Venezuela? Dan asked. Sitting next to him at the round conference table in the corner of Dan's cluttered office, Lynn Van Buren nodded, her smile bigger than usual because she had found what she'd been searching for.
Venezuela, she repeated. We can land the bird at Caracas, and we won't even have to alter its orbital track very much.
It flies over Caracas?
Pretty close. On its second orbit.
Dan started thinking out loud. We could load the ground control staff and equipment onto a ship, I suppose. Nodding enthusiastically, Van Buren said,
Use the backup equipment and a skeleton crew. You don't need more than 3-4 good people.
Put them on the ship and don't tell them where we're going, Dan mused, warming to the idea.
Or why?
That way nobody can tip off anybody outside the company about where we're going to land the bird. With a laugh, Van Buren said,
We'll sail under sealed orders.
Dan grinned back at her. That'll give us tight security, all right.
Then it's Venezuela, for sure.
Except for one point, Dan said. How in the name of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs do we get permission to fly through Venezuelan airspace and land there? Van Buren fiddled with a strand of pearls at her throat.
That's not an engineering problem, Chief.
You're right, it's a political problem.
You know any good politicians, Chief?
Van Buren asked.
Or is that an oxymoron?
Asim al-Bashir returned to Houston after his meetings in Beijing, and, with a nonchalant air of superiority, presented to Wendell Garrison a draft agreement with the Chinese government.
Tricontinental will market Chinese coal in Asia,
al-Bashir summarized for the corporate head,
as far west as Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Garrison scowled up at him. The old man wheeled his powered chair out from behind his desk and, without saying a word, led al-Bashir to the curving teak cabinet that stood at the foot of one of the ceiling-high windows. With the press of a stud on the chair's armrest,